to study this very important complex figure.
All right, starting off Living Writers this afternoon here on WCBN FM Ann Arbor. That is Vic Gallen with I'm Gone, perhaps the rarest rockabilly record out of Michigan. We'll be talking to Craig Mackey, author of a book called Handsome Victory, which chronicles the incredibly tangled story of that record and other related Motor City music doings. Welcome, Craig Mackey, to our mics this afternoon here on Living Writers.
Well, thank you, Frank. It's great to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
It was a good fortune. T. Hetzel, regular host of this show, needed a little break for a minute, and you had filled in, even though, sadly, you've messed up your wrist and your daughter drove you in. But we're going to do it.
Yeah, this is just a little setback.
I hope it's a short duration setback. Anyhow, you have books out on Detroit rockabilly and Michigan country music, mostly Detroit area, which we'll be talking about here in the next hour. Mm-hmm. And that record by Vic Gallen, which I've never seen a real copy of, is...
Same here.
Really? You don't have a real copy of it yourself?
No, good Lord, a repro came out a few years ago, and mm-hmm. I latched onto one of those.
But. Yeah, unbelievable. Well, your book, we'll talk about them in reverse order, and let me do the intro here, which I wrote down. Our guest today is Craig Mackey, the author of three books on local country and rockabilly music: Detroit Country Music, Mountaineers, Cowboys, and Rockabillies, published in 2013. You co-wrote with Keith Cady, U of M Press, put that one out. Terrific book. If you can still get easily from the U of M Press website and Craig's website, carcitycountry.com, as well as two newer books, Tomorrow Brings Memories from 2022, about Detroit's first record label of any kind or country record label.
You know, it was, I added that word underground because I wasn't sure if anybody would come out of the woodworks with new information. Mm-hmm. And come to find out, just last month, friend of mine who collects cylinders, wax cylinders, let me know that there was a company called Michigan Electric Company based down on Woodward Avenue in downtown Detroit that produced their own wax cylinders during the 1890s. So technically that was the first record company in Detroit that recorded artists in town and produced commercial recordings of them.
Wow. I love it. You can never be sure when you say something absolutely. Well, maybe, hopefully. I'm lucky. And so the Tomorrow Brings Memories book, and that was 2022. I'm finishing my intro, which I didn't finish. Handsome Victory, 2025. These are both Waxhound Press. I assume that's your own publication company? Okay. And Craig has been a disc jockey here at WCBN and other radio stations. You're also a musician, and you've played with some of the artists you've written about, which I find quite amazing. And you're an artist who does terrific illustrations for these books, which I quite like the homespun illustrations. And so, Craig, tell me, give me some, backstory. How did you start becoming... I'm going to call it, they'll use the word obsessed with Michigan music history, especially country and rockabilly.
Yeah, well, when I came to school here back in 90, 1990, 91, I started volunteering at WCBN, mm-hmm. and I got to know the guy who was doing the Rockabilly show. And he asked me to take over for him when he left town. And I was already looking up local artists because it just intrigued me. I'd never heard of these records, especially Rockabilly records being made in Detroit. But one of the last guests on the Rockabilly show before I took over brought in a stack of Fortune records.
Wow.
And so I found out about that for the first time here at WCBN. And so I started trying to look up people. And I found one guy, Don Rader, who introduced me to several others. And they introduced me to others. And I started producing interviews for my radio shows. It wasn't just Detroit people. I was talking to people who were putting out new records and things like that for the show. But that sort of got me started, and I became good friends with Jack Earls and Eddie Jackson and of course Don, and we would Eddie especially would throw parties every week at his house, mm-hmm. so there would be jam sessions all the time for me to participate in.
Now, you talked about that in the intro to this great Detroit country music book, in fact. How you first met him, I guess, in 95,
yeah.
It says. Yeah. It's just so incredible to think that, these people, no one had probably interviewed many of these people ever in decades or if ever in their careers, right?
Yeah. And Eddie had, he was just a great personality. He had a basement filled with photos that covered the walls of his time in his career in Detroit, mm-hmm. In the clubs. And where was I? he pretty much taught me how to play rhythm guitar like he did. And so that gained me access to not only his friends, but also, other musicians I encountered my age who mm-hmm. would look at what I was doing and say, how do you do that? I've never seen that before. And just meeting Eddie that... in person, he invited me to a party at a bar on 8 Mile, mm-hmm. for a friend of his who was leaving town, and I could not believe my ears when I walked in that place. They were playing Western Swing.
Wow. Like old guys.
Yeah.
Yeah. That still just carried on that tradition.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I'd never heard that music in town before.
So I had a similar experience. My wife was living in Milwaukee when we first started dating 25 or so years ago. And there was a place called Arts Polka Bar. I forget the full name. It was Arts Tavern or something, but it was like this really old group of musicians were playing polkas, and this old group of people would get up and dance. And it was like this, peek into this other world that's just kind of fading away. Was that kind of what your experience with some of these folks was? Because I remember going to the Ypsilanti Flea Market a handful of times in like the late 90s, and seeing a whole, just going in the back room, there's a whole line of like 15 people sitting in chairs strumming along and singing like Will a Circle Be Unbroken.
Yeah.
Is that the kind of vibe?
Mm-hmm. Yes. And when Keith got involved towards like the late 90s, we got together and started sharing notes because he was interested in this sort of thing too. Mm-hmm. And he was learning to play guitar and eventually upright bass. And he was playing and jamming with these people here on the west side of Detroit, mm-hmm. Who played bluegrass and old-timey music, and he got access to a whole different set of people than I had access to.
Cool.
Over on the east side.
Mm-hmm.
And it is sort of fading away now. We used to attend a lot of functions at the Kentuckians of Michigan over in Romulus.
Mm.
And a lot of the people who we used to go and have fun playing music with are no longer with us.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, when we published this book in 2013, there were only a handful of people left who we had interviewed for the book.
Wow. That's just so remarkable that you were able to catch the spirit just before it was too late, because... I read books where people are reconstructing things based on like old interviews, but they don't have any living people to really give a perspective of what it was like. And it makes such a difference to be able to ask that person, well, you know, like you were just saying, how did you play that kind of rhythm guitar? I mean, I'm so glad that you guys were able to. And I used to listen to Keith's radio show on Suds, and it was such a great show, man. He would it didn't come in that well here, but I would figure out a way to hear it because I was like, this is some, you know, deep history.
Yep.
Did he collaborate with you on these books at all, or you used some of his older interviews or your older interviews together?
Yeah. I referred to some of the research that he had done when we were working on the Detroit Country Music book quite a bit. Yeah.
So tell me about I'm getting to your newest book, Handsome Victory, and we just heard that tune, "I'm Gone" by Vic Gallen, and I read this book a couple nights ago all the way through, and it's a fascinating story because very few people have ever heard or seen a copy of this record, and it's insanely rare. But yet, the lead guitar is played by a young Dennis Coffey, who's a legend and still out there, right? He wrote an autobiography recently, or maybe 20 years ago now.
Yeah, it was about 20 years ago. U of M Press published his Guitars, Bars, and Motown Superstars.
Yeah.
And Dennis is probably one of the main reasons why I was able to do this book, because he was the only eyewitness to the whole thing, the only person who has ever reported on it and shared any kind of stories about it. Yeah, it was kind of a mystery record, and as you said, one of the rarest out there. Someone found a second version of the song that we heard at the top of the show. And this was about 15 years ago, and they put it out on a couple of compilations and under the Vic Gallen name. But I found out that Vic Gallen was a pen name.
Mm.
So the story, the book tells the story of how I figured out the rest of the story.
We don't want to spoil it. Spoiler alert, we won't tell you all the final details, but I mean, one of the aspects that was also fascinating was the story of the guy, the recording engineer, because that recording sounds so good. I mean, the echo and everything, and it was a guy who had cerebral palsy.
Yes,
and it was like his basement, his parents' basement, and yet he managed to start a business and record a lot of artists, I guess, over the years.
Yeah, and a friend of mine said recently told me that he had found a lacquer covered disc, a demo from his studio that dates to about 1980, early 80s. So he was active for a pretty long time, from about 50 to 80.
Wow.
And it's just remarkable that that this young man was able to do what he did. Was never really referred to by name by people who we talked to, Keith and I talked to, who had made recordings there.
Mm-hmm.
But I did track down this promoter and musician named Tommy Morris. His son is still around. And I tracked him down and talked to him about it. And he said, well, the studio man's name was Julian Skinner, and he said that he had a very difficult time conversing because of his disabilities.
Mm-hmm.
So, on the other hand, he was a genius in the studio.
Yeah. No, I mean, you do some discography about some of the Northwest Sound label, like Nick Harris and the Sound Barriers. But it sounds like he was also doing like the typical, high school band, choir, orchestra kind of albums with generic covers. Did you ever figure out how to assemble a list of those? Or
no, unless it was on his label and somebody documented it. I don't. Yeah, and I'm amazed that there were a couple of. There's a bluegrass session and two rockabilly sessions.
Okay.
Besides the Vic Gallen stuff, that the music has been out there for years, and nobody knew that they were done here at Northwest Sound Company with Julian Skinner.
Wow. Yeah, again, I love the fact that you're digging up these untold stories, otherwise completely undocumented stories, and when they come to light, they're fascinating, because the people were doing this stuff. I mean, I like people that are a little off the grid doing this stuff that wasn't, they just were doing it, you know, and they weren't like trying to necessarily be superstars, but they just believed in what they were doing. And now we can appreciate it and think, my goodness, that still sounds great, you know?
Yeah.
So.
Yep. That's definitely a major part of the story. And, you know, I'll tell you a little secret. At first, I had it wrong.
Oh, yeah.
There was another guy who was a polio survivor who was handicapped a bit, and he had a reputation around the country musicians, including Eddie Jackson. He knew this guy, and he used to make recordings at his house.
Wow!
In the New Center area. So I thought at first it was this guy, but then my good pal Michael Hurt said, you need to think about this other guy.
Okay.
You know, from Northwest Sound. And I said, I do? Oh, okay, I'll check it out. And then I was like, and then it hit me like a truck, you know, holy cow, this is it.
You've got a good set of resources, because Hurt seems to always know, have that little bell ringing in the back of his mind to dig a little deeper, you know.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, that Fortune Records book, obviously, he and Billy Miller did is beyond compare. I mean, that's standard that will never be equal, probably, for music history books.
Yeah, I agree.
But I want to cover all your work here, and we have maybe time for a little break. Why don't we set us up for talking a little bit about Tomorrow Brings Memories with a tune? And if you can tell, Jason, I should have credited Through the Glass, as T says, Behind the Glass. Is ready. What do you want?
Number 9, Jason.
Awesome. Thank you, Jason. And again, this is Craig Mackey here on Living Writers on WCBN FM Ann Arbor. Frank Yulee sitting in for T. Hetzel.
About your trucking mama, boys, I've got one. She's a Hamtramck baby and she has her fun. She's a Hamtramck mama and she sure does know her stuff. She's the hottest thing in town, Lordy, how she can love. Oh, she's trucking in the daytime, shimming at night. She's a Hamtramck mama and she shakes it right. She's a Hamtramck mama and she sure does know her stuff. She's the hottest thing in town, Lordy, how she can love.
So those are the York Brothers with Hamtramck Mama. That's the original 1939 recording of that tune?
It is.
Excellent.
Straight from the 78.
All right. And I was listening closely to the lyrics as your previous book, Tomorrow Brings Memories, about Detroit's first underground record company, goes into great detail about that particular recording. And why don't you give us some of the background on that one.
All right. Well, there were couple of guys in town who were in the jukebox business. One of them was a guy named Harry Graham, who worked for Wolverine Specialties Company, which was a division of Marquette Music Company. Marquette was the largest jukebox operator in Michigan, in the state, and they were based in Detroit. And Harry apparently paid for a session to make some records that he could sell to his to his customers. And one of them was Hamtramck Mama by the Yark Brothers. And the Yark Brothers were completely unknown at the time, except in Detroit. And they had just come up maybe a year before then from Southeast Ohio. Actually, they were grew up in Kentucky, but they were living in Ohio at the time. And they put out this record, this East Side studio called Universal Recording Studios had a just a custom sort of operation there. They would put out records people wanted recorded for vanity reasons or what have you. But this was a commercial thing that Harry Graham wanted to get going. And he started with 2,000 copies. And he sold right out of them. So he ordered some more, and then he ordered some more, and then he ordered some more. He just kept selling and selling. Hamtramck Mama became a hit in Detroit, and then the word spread around the region, and the Yark Brothers got very popular, and also attracted the attention of the Hamtramck City Council and Mayor, who ordered a ban of the record within their city borders. So that made the record even more popular. And reportedly, it sold 300,000 copies in the city of Detroit alone. There, wow. I counted six different pressings.
Wow.
Six different labels, anyway.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Eventually, Universal got attracted the attention of one jukebox operator named Ed Kiley, who sort of took over, seemed to have taken over the operations and started making new records and for the jukebox business, and created one called Hot Wax, and then he settled on one called Mellow. And this was all before the end of World War II. And the Yark Brothers are so successful in town, mm-hmm. that I counted 35 commercial sides. So they pressed a lot of records, especially for a small operation.
Mm-hmm.
And this was just before the shellac drives and right after the end of the Great Depression,
mm-hmm.
or as the Depression ended, which mm-hmm. had wiped out a lot of most independent companies. So it was pretty remarkable business story.
Yeah. Well, one thing I'm also interested in you point out in the book is that those many, many sales it wasn't like today. A lot of those sales were to jukebox players.
Uh-huh.
So I think you said in the book that you could play a jukebox 78 about 85 times and you'd have to get a new one in. So
right. mm-hmm.
that people weren't buying them and listening to them at home.
No, that's couldn't go. Yeah, I even found a thing in the newspaper, in an old newspaper about this. You could not go to your music shop and buy the record.
Really?
I think it was the Detroit Times, or maybe it was the news that mm-hmm. reported that the Grinnell Music Company was looking for whoever was selling the Yark Brothers Hamtramck Mama, because they were getting inundated by requests for it, and you couldn't do it. You had to know a jukebox operator and where to get them.
That's amazing. Do you have any, I don't recall if you got any kind of profitability numbers, or did the Yark Brothers make a big amount of money from this, or was it mostly just the record company and they got paid a session fee and got kind of shafted in the royalties, or?
Probably the latter.
Yeah.
I really don't know. Yeah. I do know that when the Yark Brothers decided to join the Navy at the beginning of 44,
mm-hmm.
they reported, they filled out a form for the Army or for the Navy.
Mm-hmm.
They both joined the Navy separately.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the lines asked them to report their weekly income, and they were earning hundreds of dollars a week.
Really?
Back then.
And
so,
that's a big salary in those days. Yeah.
Yeah. So they were doing pretty good.
Hmm. Wow. No, I love that record. And again, this book, you you tie that to later developments. And again, we mentioned Fortune Records, mm-hmm. but...
Yeah, it's a bizarre thing.
Yeah, the whole concept, and I'm curious if this was already an established tradition of the sort of party record or the risque lyrics. I mean, it was certainly the case in like blues and rhythm and blues, you know, from the dawn of the recording era and obviously before they were recorded, but mm-hmm. Like country music records with kind of naughty lyrics. And when you listen to that song, you're like, this is banned. It isn't. She shook it left and right. I mean, it's not that really risque, but were they kind of, I think you kind of implied that they were like the first people in the Detroit area to do that kind of a thing.
Yeah. As far as I know, the most easily identifiable,
yeah.
They did, like, there was, I found one previous record on Universal, which was a German brass band,
mm-hmm.
and it was good music, but it wasn't mm-hmm. risque. It was just in two instrumentals.
Yeah.
So, you know, Harry Graham by no means was an upstanding citizen himself.
Right, you're going to the past of these guys. They sound a little rough and tumble.
Yeah, and Kylie was an ex-con.
Leavenworth, right?
Yeah.
I love it, man.
Yep. So they sort of, I mean, there were major labels were the only guys operating during the Depression. So if they put out risque stuff, you know, mm-hmm. there was...
True.
They had more resources to cover their tails.
Mm-hmm.
These guys figured out a way to make money in town, and I mean, basically, it was a regional business mm-hmm. model. So, I think, once they figured out that this was going to make them money, they produced a few more by other artists, including, well, I mean, the York Brothers made a couple more too. But
right, like Highland Park Girl.
Yeah,
they're like, let's do different Detroit suburbs here. Yeah.
Detroit cool. Hulu Girl.
Yeah. Yeah, that, I love it. And again, the Fortune Records folks seized on that, and they actually ended up later, I guess, buying the masters of these tunes.
Yeah, somehow they got hold of those and used them.
But yeah, I have some 78s. Obviously, The Tattooed Lady by Skeets McDonald.
Yeah.
And, Detroit, The Dirty Boogie, Roy Hall. I love those Fortune. They just kept doing it. Jack Brown, I guess, was even selling records under the counter, right?
Right. He got fined for that.
Yeah.
He got caught by the police for that. But yeah, but eventually, as you read in the book, they mm-hmm. the York Brothers made just a handful of recordings in town, and mm-hmm. then Decca Records signed them.
Right.
So they went to Chicago and recorded for Decca six sides that were released on 78s.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And then they came back, and that was the end of their. I mean, from there on, they took a more professional approach to making music and mm-hmm. and made all kinds of different records, all kinds of different experimental ways to experiment with songs. I mean, there were sound effects added to some, like a train whistle.
Cool.
And Leslie York was just a brilliant songwriter when he was making these recordings.
And, wow.
And another thing I document is how their act changed. At first, they were just two brothers with acoustic guitars, and then eventually, their last recordings included George playing rhythm guitar with his acoustic flat top. Leslie played his acoustic flat top with a pickup in it, so he was playing electric sounding guitars, and then they had a hot bass player. A guy who slapped the bass on these recordings, and it sounded a lot like the early records that Johnny Cash made at Sun, and even some of Elvis's earliest stuff.
Wow. No, that's again, it's amazing to document this stuff because the, you know, time goes on and this stuff gets forgotten, and yet it's a vital, you know, Detroit. You know, as today remembered for Motown, of course, and a few other, like more recent years, techno and electronic music and stuff like that, and jazz. But, you know, when I have a small collection of some of the Fortune 78s in particular, not the earlier ones. I think I have I have one Mellow 78, and of course, I can't find anything in my attic. But those are some of those late 40s country records in Detroit. I'm getting back to your first book, are just superb. You know, I mean, they're just hot records.
Oh yeah, those Roy Hall records were done in one morning. Bud White said that they had only been playing together for a week or two at the nightclub, and then they got the band together to go make records, and they just sound absolutely tremendous.
Oh my gosh. And I guess in the earlier days, Fortune was actually using like a real studio, like United Sound Systems. They didn't have the back room or the record store, so because those 40s Fortune 78 sound really hot. I mean, they're
Eddie told me that he made his for Fortune at Music Hall.
Okay.
There was a studio there. And Al Allen, the guitar player, said that, not on Eddie's records, he played with Jack Scott and a number of other people. He said that he recorded there too for another label called Citation.
Ah, I have a Citation by Johnny White too.
Yeah, yes.
It's a nice one. Real good one.
I was surprised to hear there was a recording studio at Music Hall. I wonder if it's still there.
You know, it's interesting. I'm probably going to get really lambasted for being wrong, but a guy who was in a band in the 60s called the Bobians, who actually recorded their one and only 45 here, right around where we're sitting, in 1967, the guy, lead guitarist Don Tappert, was in a band in the 70s in the Cass Corridor called the Tappert Sparling Band. And they recorded some tracks that just came out on Third Man Records last year. I think they were recorded in that studio you're talking about in like the mid-70s. It was a recording studio in like a big concert hall. Is that that's the same
thing? Could be.
Yeah. Anyway, why don't we get into some of that next vibe here? Because we were talking about Eddie Jackson a little bit. Is that a tune you would select for our...
There's one. Track 15, Jason. This was actually a local hit for Eddie in 63. It's called I'm Learning.
Okay, what label was that cut for?
Caravan.
Okay.
He was working at Caravan Gardens, and the owner heard him play it one night, and he said, "We need to make a record of that." So they did.
All right, let's hear Eddie Jackson.
I've never ever been this low in my life. Never knew a heartache could cut you like a knife. But I'm learning. I'm learning. I never cried a tear, never had the blues, never knew the hurt of when you love and lose. But I'm learning. I'm learning. To hide my emotion, I never let a tear show through. Let no one get the foolish notion.
That's Eddie Jackson singing I'm Learning here on Living Writers. We're talking to Craig Mackey, author of the most recent book, Handsome Victory, about the Vic Gallen Rockabilly Legendary 45, and Tomorrow Brings Memories about the York Brothers Hamtramck Mama label, Universal and its offshoots. And of course, from about a decade ago, the great Detroit country music, Mountaineers, Cowboys, and Rockabillies with Keith Cady, published by U of M Press. And Eddie Jackson is featured heavily in that book.
Yeah, he's on the cover.
Exactly. And you played with him and you got to know him a little bit. That's so cool. One of the things I'm really curious about is you alluded to this, but the bar scene, this Detroit country music, you know, there were lots of little labels putting out kind of records that maybe only got local attention. few bands, a few artists made it to bigger labels like Jimmy Work and folks and Roy Hall. But basically, this music was live music. This was like, as opposed to, I don't know, some different genres of music where a lot of it is like in the studio, you're trying to make a hit. There were people going to getting beers at a whole bunch of different country music venues in Detroit. And this was, well, you tell me the background of this, because I'm really curious about how the Detroit country scene came from people mostly from the South that were working in the auto factories.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's pretty much the gist of it. Yeah. There was work up here during the Great Depression, so a lot of people moved up, and then the bars were, I mean, you could go to nice places, or you could go to places that were referred to as bucket of bloods. You know, there were fights breaking out every night.
Okay.
They all needed entertainment, and a lot of people cut their teeth in these bars playing music. In the 50s in particular, after the war, stations like WJR had not only a disc jockey show, but they had a jamboree going on Saturday nights. WWJ-TV had one. There was a lot of attention paid to country music in town, even if and there were a lot of people who, like as you said, made it to major labels or got attention, went on to Nashville, and made a career out of music down there. Casey Clark led the biggest band in town. He did TV, he did radio. In fact, he led the bands, the first bands on WJR. Doing records, making records, and they played all kinds of stuff. They had a weekly barn dance at the Union Hall on 12101 Mack Avenue, which unfortunately does no longer exist. Mm. But they played a variety of music there. I mean, they would play all the popular country tunes, no matter what, if it was honky tonk, western swing. They'd play old time fiddle tunes. They'd do square dances there, bluegrass, and then even a little rock and roll. And it was, I've seen photos of the place. It was packed. It was packed. Unbelievable.
Wow. And that's in the days when, we probably opened the door and just like a wall of smoke came out, right? I mean, it was not for the kiddies. It was adults. And it was, I mean, I'm picturing, you know.
Well, the barn dance was family friendly.
Oh, that's true. Yeah. Okay. Tell me more about, some of that different vibes that they had.
Well, I mean, a lot of people liked to square dance back then. So that was a very popular thing. And there were square dances and shows put on all over town. Not only Casey Clark's, but Jimmy Williams had some things going in the northern suburbs. And, I think Ralph Davis was doing a little bit of that on the west side. I'm sure I'm forgetting somebody because there were so many. Mm-hmm. In fact, to tell you a little tidbit about this book, I had turned in a 200,000 word manuscript and they asked me to cut it to 100.
Yeah, that would make sense.
So I dedicated the book to just everybody who was involved, because we couldn't get all the names in there and all the stories.
No, I you know, having written a book on the film scene here in Ann Arbor, once you start digging into those rabbit holes, it's hard not to stop. But did the full 200,000 words, you condense it, or did you just have to chop out stuff?
A little bit of both, yeah. Mm-hmm. Some of it wound up on my Car City Country website.
Mm.
And that was an interesting thing, too, to do, because I'd post things and then I'd hear from people who knew what I was posting about.
Okay.
Like family members and friends. Mm. And so I would get more, receive more information that way.
Mm-hmm.
Just so that was a really interesting side project.
No, I mean, that's terrific. And I'm sure, you know, again, looking at some of the credits in the book, in this particular book, well, all your books, you did a lot of research. I mean, there's the Detroit Public Library had some archival materials that were helpful, and I guess you even went to the Country Music Hall of Fame.
Yeah, yeah. The Frist Library and Archive is a great resource. They have since moved some things to digital,
okay,
which is really cool.
Mm-hmm.
I just found a couple of crazy things that I'd never expected to. One of them was an interview with Colonel Jim Wilson, who makes an appearance in the in my latest book, Handsome Victory.
Mm-hmm.
He was the manager of the King Records distribution office in Detroit.
Wow!
From like 49 to 64. So they had an interview with him, like a lengthy thing that John Rumble did over several days. It's fascinating stuff.
Wow. So they preserve like oral histories of people.
Yeah.
Like industry mm-hmm. people, not just the famous players or whatever.
Yeah. And it's mostly based, most of their research was based in Nashville. So, you know, when I went down there, I met John Rumble, but I guess he forgot that I would be interested in that sort of thing. I found this one online a few months ago.
Oh, wow. Yeah, that's the peril of publishing something. You have it, it's in hard copy, and it's not a living document anymore, and you have to occasionally be like, oh, geez, I wish I'd known that. But
well, I've been making notes, and I'm ready for a second volume, second edition.
That's what you should do. No, I mean, it's, again, getting it out there. As you just indicated, sometimes it starts the ball rolling toward more stuff popping up to light.
Absolutely,
so that's all good too. But I mean, yes, so many of the artists in here. I collect records. I've poured through many, probably millions of 45s at this point. But I've never seen records by a lot of these people that you wrote about. I mean, I've never. Maybe I didn't notice them too closely, but I don't have any records by like Rufus Schaffner or, Eddie Jackson himself. I mean, you see like Jimmy Work, Skeets McDonald, mm-hmm. York Brothers Records, but I mean, some of these were like little local labels. Were a lot of the artists putting out things on their own labels, or were there, I know there was like the Happy Hearts, mm-hmm. put out local country for a few years, or Pathways in Ypsilanti. There would be these little operations, but man, those records today are rare. I don't know how their distribution worked, or if it was a pay-as-you-go operation or something? Like the artist paid sort of a vanity press price?
Yeah. That was a common thing.
I see.
Yeah. Now, Eddie said that when he recorded for Fortune in 56 and mm-hmm. made that Rock and Roll Baby record,
mm-hmm.
they asked him to record for them.
Okay.
But we talked with other people, like Ralph Davis,
mm-hmm.
who in some cases they actually went to other studios, made the tapes, and then went to Fortune and said, can you press these up?
I see.
And they said, sure, give us $300 or whatever.
Interesting.
During the 40s, it was all about jukeboxes.
Right.
Like Jimmy Work got his start with jukebox labels, and Tennessee Border was a special thing that he arranged with a jukebox operator. There was a plant up in Owosso.
Oh, yeah, American Record Pressing,
yeah.
ARP. You see it stamped in the dead wax on those 45s.
Right, yeah. It was Desha Industries at first in the 40s, and then they were pressing things on a Vargo record label.
Oh, yeah, I remember seeing a picture of that in your book, exactly.
Yeah. And then several guys in Detroit eventually bought it, including, I think, Jimmy Syracuse from United Sound Systems was one of them. But you get into the 50s, and that sort of vanity press package becomes more ubiquitous. Mm-hmm. The Vic Gallen record was something like that.
That label is that one I can recall noticing. Gondola?
I know.
I mean, you have an interesting theory about the
gone dollar.
Yeah, in the book. But were there other issues on that label that you've seen or no?
No.
Yeah.
Wow. Nope. And it's funny that the label has printed all over it, free copy, DJ only, you know, right. Promotional. So you couldn't, you know, if you wound up with a box of them, who are you going to sell them to, you know?
Right. I mean, it's interesting because one of the people I'm always touting is an Ann Arbor soul music entrepreneur, Ali McLaughlin. And he ran Karen, Carla, Moira record labels, and he had a couple of imprints, OMAC and Ruth. And he would press up like 100 copies, and he was a DJ, so he would send them out to his radio friends.
Yeah.
And if it didn't get any traction, he wouldn't press store copies. So that's why some of his records are worth, you know, $2,000 now.
Wow.
Because Jimmy Delph's maybe best recording, Dancing Hole in the World, was only, the DJs were like, I'm not going to play that. So.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, so you go from jukebox operators getting all the records to a lot of DJs getting the records and the jukebox guys too in the 50s.
Yeah.
It's, some of those were, like you said, if they pressed something and the distributor or the label owner didn't see any traction, they just, it's like Johnny Powers, long blonde hair.
Right.
And he saw that note going nowhere, so he went to this Julian Skinner at Northwest Sound Company and made a new set of tunes, cut a new set of tunes to try to attract some attention.
Mm-hmm. And I think Johnny Powers himself ended up in a vanity press operation, right?
Sound Inc., yeah.
Sound Inc. He was part of that, putting out tons of polka records and stuff.
Yep, in the 60s, yeah.
Why don't we take another quick hit of a short segment of a tune and pick a good, is there a good rocker on there?
Let's see.
Let's talk a little bit about rockabilly for the last little bit.
Probably number 5, Johnny Powers.
Let's hear some Johnny Powers. Thanks again, Jason, behind the glass. Powers with I'm Walking Here on WCBN's Living Writers. Special guest today, Craig Mackey, author of Handsome Victory, most recently, Tomorrow Brings Memories, and Detroit Country Music. So we talked a lot about country, and you know, rockabilly, country's got a long lifespan. I feel like rockabilly, there are certainly are bands who do rockabilly to this day, but rockabilly was there for maybe 5 years before it kind of was no longer, no one could sell a rockabilly record, and I don't think bands were performing rockabilly.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, you got that right. It's a friend of mine used to say that as soon as Elvis added drum, rockabilly was done. but yeah, I mean, they used to call it rock and roll. I mean, everybody we talked to said it was rock and roll.
Yeah.
You know, we never called it rockabilly, we called it rock and roll.
Yeah.
And rock and roll changed. You know, so
yeah. But Johnny Powers, I mean, Detroit had a some pretty good bopping records. Obviously, I mean, Jack Scott cut those killer early ones on ABC.
Yeah,
And then, you know, switched over to Carlton, kept going pretty good, and then kind of watered down like so many people. But yeah, there were a few. I mean, obviously Fortune put out its share. Mm-hmm. And Ollie McLaughlin, I'll just tout, put out the great Got the Bug.
Bug, yeah.
45. And so, you know, they're, but again, one of the things that this is getting back to your current book, Handsome Victory, this mystery artist, mm-hmm. Vic Gallen, cut this interesting demo. And what happened to it? How did, what do you think did the purpose of it was? And was this a band that played around a lot? Or it was kind of a recording session. It wasn't so much like, oh, I've got a whole band. We're going to come in the studio and cut our tune that we do on stage every night.
Right. Yeah. The record was just basically a pickup group, mm-hmm. that Dennis Coffey assembled. He was a high schooler. He was in his teenage years, and he couldn't even drive at the time. And they had to ask a friend of theirs who played music in country bars to drive him there to the studio. And he had never met this guy, this Vic Gallen. He just called him out of the blue and showered Dennis with praise and said, you know, I've seen you playing. You sound great. Can you put together a band? I want to make a record. And he said, oh, okay. So they did it. And Dennis got paid and heard from Vic Gallen a few weeks later after he got the record in the mail.
Okay. So
Gallen sent him a copy of it. And he said, I'm going to be on the radio this afternoon on Sagebrush Melodies on WEXL Radio Ann Arbor, or Royal Oak.
Okay.
And he heard him on the radio, and that was the last time Dennis ever heard from him again. That was it. So, it's part of the interest. What interested me was how Dennis started here and then became what he became, you know, just a groundbreaking, trend-setting guitarist.
Absolutely, yeah. And, you know, part of the Funk Brothers, Motown session musicians, who mm-hmm. weren't called the Funk Brothers, I always get told that at the time. But, yeah, like Papa was a Rolling Stone. He's playing the heavy guitar on that. And he obviously had his own, you know, early 70s hit Scorpio. But Vic Gallen vanished into the ether, as it were, until you decided to figure out what the story was.
Yeah. Yeah, I could not find any contemporary references to Vic Gallen. No one we ever talked, Keith and I ever talked with, or Michael ever talked with, had mentioned his name. So, I had to look elsewhere.
Mm-hmm. No, it's quite a detective story, and you know, I don't think I'm going to reveal too many spoilers, but you found this, you know, alternate version of the tune that hadn't been released. And so you obviously, I think, you know, the research, I'm reading between the lines here, was helped by things appearing online, deep databases of sessions and things that wouldn't have been accessible years ago.
Oh, yeah. Well, a friend of mine, yeah, the internet was very helpful for those reasons. Mm-hmm. Also because my friends overseas were able to help me. Mm-hmm. A friend of mine had that Mercury sessionography.
Oh, that's where that information came from.
And I actually came out here to Ann Arbor to look at it in person because the U of M library has a copy of
it. Nice.
But before I did that, my friend in Germany had a copy of it, and he took a photo of it and sent me the pages I was after.
I see.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that it's a miracle that that information even exists in human form, because not that many people would care or you know, have access to logs of unreleased recordings.
Yeah, the page had a list of just all the sessions, mm-hmm. in supposedly chronological order, mm-hmm. and whether they were issued or unissued, it was just a little note next to the titles. And besides all that, the music that I cover in the book goes into the early 70s.
Right.
And even touches on the demise of Starday Records, or its downward trajectory.
Mm-hmm. No, some of those other later recordings sound really fascinating, too.
Yeah, I was a little surprised. I wound up heading into country rock and exploring that a little bit. But then there were some things that were recorded in 68, one by a local guy, Billy Golden,
okay,
who was based in Taylor, Michigan at the time. He had a small hit, a regional hit, first on the Country 4 label, which was his, and mm-hmm. then Stardate picked it up, and then they made a whole album, a few singles and a whole album with the guy. He was a great singer. It's too bad his career didn't really take off.
Yeah.
And Guy Mitchell, who was born in Detroit.
Oh, that's a more familiar name.
Yeah. And, he was a hit maker in the 50s. Mm-hmm. Made his number one hits with country songs, pop versions of country songs.
Singing the blues.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And, Kenny Roberts, yodeling Kenny Roberts, who was based in Saginaw at the time. Yeah, so there are some interesting Michigan connections all the way through.
Mm-hmm. And again, the obscurity of this record and the greatness of this record combined to make it, I guess someone has recently bootlegged the 45, or
yeah,
not super recently, but there's a bootleg with both the official version and the alternate version.
Yes, yes. There was a second version discovered on a lacquer-covered record, mm-hmm. demo record, and I think probably the guy who wound up with that record probably mm-hmm. put this 45 out with mm-hmm. the original "I'm Gone" and then the new one that the recently found version.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and again, it all tracks back to Detroit with Ernie Durham, the DJ. I like that too.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Yeah, Ernie was a terrific announcer. I used to listen to him on WDET. He was on there.
Oh, was he still on there?
Yeah,
wow.
Towards the end, yeah.
Man, I never heard that. Yeah, Billy, I'm looking through the book here. You got nice reproductions of the labels. Wild, Wild Thing. I've got to seek that record out. Is that on?
I think it's on there.
Oh, good. We're gonna. Well, yeah. That'll be our closer.
Okay.
Yeah. Cue up. Get ready, Jason.
Number seven.
We're getting close. Yeah, we're getting close. Anyhow, well, listen, Craig. It's just been so wonderful talking to you. And again, if folks can pick up these books, they're available. I know at BookBeat has them. Mm-hmm. Signed copies. That's where I got mine. And the wonderful illustrations. And label shots, and it's just fascinating to get into a topic where you've never heard of any of these musicians, but the stories are so fascinating, and they tie together. And the story of the recording engineer who had hard challenges, and yet produced these incredible sounds, and then the tie into later, Scorpio, Dennis Coffey. It's really cool. So I commend you for putting these many hours into creating these books, including all the time you spent drawing the pictures of the performers.
Yeah, it's labors of love.
Yeah,
and they're in this convenient pocketbook size.
Yeah,
I found that I can slip these into the back of my jeans pockets when I go crate digging.
That is a nice feature, and there's nice discographies at the end too, of the. I got to dig out my Nick Barris and the Sound Barrier 45s now from Northwest. Anyway, I just hope that our listeners have enjoyed this chat with Craig Mackey, author of these fine books documenting some of the forgotten stories of Detroit's country music and rockabilly. And take a look out for those books and go to carcitycountry.com. For more stories that aren't in the books and more information, you can buy the books directly from that site, I'm pretty sure.
There are links, yeah.
Excellent. Mm-hmm.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
It's been a blast.
I'd like to say hi to T, by the way.
And T. Hetzel will be back next week. And Jason, let's hear from Billy Golden and, I love the title, Wild, Wild Thing.
I was born on the breeze, raised beneath the trees, and the night courthouse burned, they lost my name. I've got hot blood inside of this mountain of pride, and
when you're fooling with a wild, wild thing. Go tell your mama that you're fooling with a wild, wild thing. I've got memories so unkind, they left scars on my mind. Cheating women and good booze and lost a sting. I'll hurt you till you cry, but I'll ramble till I die, and you're fooling with a wild, wild thing.
This is Jerry of Devo.
Hey, this is Bob 2 of Devo.
This is Jeff from Devo.
Oh, ha, ha, listen up, guys. This is Bob 1 from Devo.
Greetings, beautiful mutants. This is Mark of Devo, and you are listening to WCBN FM.
Ann Arbor, Michigan.
88.3. Probably the most important radio station in the whole planet.
So do not change the channel. Just listen to, stay where you are.
Welcome to the not so daily, not so sports report this afternoon. Excuse me, actually, it's early evening. My name is Sarah Min, and instead of sports, we're going to have a half hour of Matmos. Hope you enjoy.
Sunshine. Lunchbox. Playground. Raincoat. Hot dog. Oatmeal. Railroad. Ice cream. Bathtub. Pancake. Eardrum. Sunshine. Lunchbox. Playground. Dog.